The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
She's got the news. She talks with newsmakers. She encourages us to laugh, and she cries with us. Speaking truth to power and questioning authority daily, it's the Nicole Sandler Show.
All right, welcome to a brand new week. It's a Monday. Oh, usually we hate Mondays, but this is okay because we got a busy show for you today. If you're watching on one of the video streams, you may notice I look a little different. Yeah, you see, my hair was getting really long. And we did this once before. I had David cut it for me, and it came out okay. This time, it did not. This time, you know, last time I was so careful. I, like, put rubber bands on. I said, cut it right below the rubber. This time, I said, just, yeah, go, like, right below my shoulder so that when it's dry, it'll just hit my shoulder. And what I got was not that. It was crooked. And it was really, 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 really short. So I wound up going to get to a professional to get it fixed. This is so not my style. It's really short, but it's a bob. I got a bob. So this is all blow dried and coiffed. I'm not big on the coiffing, so we'll see what happens. I'm sure it won't look nearly this cool after I wash it and try to style it myself. But for now, it's kind of cool, right? Kind of cool. There it is from the back. You should see what it looked like before. I won't show you because it was horrible. Horrible. So anyway, wasn't planning on getting a haircut, but let me tell you, the guy that I found, I didn't go to my usual person because frankly, I went on the website and they do not require masks or any COVID precautions. So I'm like, bye-bye. And I found this guy, actually found him on Groupon, so I got a great deal on it anyway. Reviews were excellent, and he requires a mask, and he's vaccinated. And it's one of those, this is a new thing, where they have these suites. So it's a big salon company, but it's all individual rooms. So each stylist has their own place. So it's just me and this guy in there. So I felt comfortable with it. It wore the mask the whole time. He wore a mask the whole time. We were both vaccinated. And I felt okay about it. Because after all, I am in Florida. And Florida is, the COVID is still raging here. And it's because we have this idiot in Tallahassee calling the shots. And hopefully, we're going to replace him soon. And I'm very excited that we've got a busy, busy show for you today, because coming up a little later is one of my favorite journalists, actually one of the best reporters in the business. His name is Jim DeFede. He and I worked together, so I can say that. I produced his morning show on WINZ in Miami back in 2005, I believe. And then he left and I took over the morning show on WINZ. This is when South Florida had a progressive talk station. And then after I hosted the morning show for about a year, the station was owned by the company then known as Clear Channel. Now they're known as I Hurt Radio. I'm sorry, it's I Hate Radio. Either way, they killed off South Florida's only progressive talk station to put the fifth sports talk station on the air in South Florida. It's still there. It's still sports, and it has worse ratings than we did as a progressive talk station, in case you were wondering. So anyway, Jim DeFede will join us after the bottom of the hour. But for now, we have a wonderful guest that I'm excited to speak with. She is one of the people running to replace the guy who's occupying the governor's office. Now, the guy who I refer to as Moron Death Sentence, more commonly known as Ron DeSantis, but more on death sentence seems to work better. Nikki Fried, welcome to the show. It's so nice to meet you.
Oh, thanks for having me. And definitely tell Jim DeFede I say hello later.
I will do that. He's going to be on right after you. Who knows? There may even be some overlap. We'll see. Anyway, so yeah, Jim is great. He's, for those who don't know, he's been a longtime Florida reporter, and he knows the ins and outs of Florida politics probably better than anyone else. He's an investigative reporter, but he does the show Facing South Florida for the CBS station in Miami, and he knows his stuff. He's got it all down. So I love picking his brain. But now, Nikki Fried, we get to pick yours. First of all, I have to say, a fellow Nikki, you're also a Nicole, right? I grew up, I was Nikki, N-I-K-K-I. And now just my family still calls me Nikki, and friends from way back. So we have that in common. Tell us about you.
Yeah, I'm definitely Nicole. The only time that I get called Nicole was when I used to actually be in the courtroom. And I used to make my clients and then obviously the judges. And when my dad gets mad at me, he still calls me Nicole.
Yes. No, I remember all through school, through elementary and high school, first day of school, they'd go down, you know, the names, Nicole Sandler. Yeah, it's Nikki. It was always Nikki as a kid. And then once I got out of college, I thought, I guess I should be Nicole now. So anyway, it was an unusual name when I was a kid. I'm a bit older than you are. Now there are Nikkis everywhere. So we're trailblazers. Anyway, Nikki Fried, a lot of people who are listening maybe don't know you. You are the Commissioner of Agriculture and Consumer Services here in Florida. That's sort of a weird combination, is it? Agriculture and consumer services, why do they go together?
Yeah, so there's like some history on this. So the Ag Commissioner is in our Constitution. And when they had over time kind of changed the makeup of the cabinet, they got rid of some positions. And so over time, they kept trying to figure out, well, who was going to be responsible for this activity or who's responsible for that one? And at the time, there was an ag commissioner who kept just raising his hand and said, we'll take it over here. And so they expanded this position to not just be agriculture, but agriculture and consumer services. The other aspect of it is there were some times when there was a threat to taking it out of the Constitution. And so the ag community felt, well, maybe if we just create such a big position with so many responsibilities, that will help us keep the Commissioner of Agriculture as a constitutional officer.
Did you have any involvement with the world of agriculture before taking on this position?
Well, I came from the marijuana space. So that's kind of where my ag background comes from is I was very involved in the medical marijuana program here in the state of Florida. Also one of the lead just government consultants across the country on this issue. So I do fundamentally believe that the future of agriculture is the cannabis plant. And so feeling that that's kind of where the synergy had come from when I decided to run for ag commissioner.
You know, I love hearing that. I'm astounded. Look, we live in the Sunshine State. Things grow here like weeds. Go figure. Weeds. The fact that we're not growing it and taxing it and making a fortune and filling our coffers is frankly astounding to me. But, you know, you won't appreciate it. But as I refer to the state, it's Florida. I want to get the duh out of Florida. So, yep. This sounds like a no-brainer to me, but hey, we were on the road to getting close to having recreational marijuana on the ballot coming up, and then all of a sudden we're not. What happened with that?
It's unfortunate. The Supreme Court kicked the ballot initiative, two of them, actually. There was two ballot initiatives that were being worked on. One that basically regulated it no different than they do alcohol. So basically, like you see the alcohol stores and licensing underneath that. The other one was a more restricted program, but still allowing for access and for legalization. The Supreme Court kicked both of those initiatives out. Obviously, I do not agree with that ruling by any stretch of the imagination. And, you know, just a little concerned about some of the rulings coming out of the Supreme Court. There is another initiative, though, that just popped last week that is really more towards legalizing home grow and allowing each person in a household to have 9 plants to grow at home. Yes. And if there's 2 adults, then it's 18 plants that are allowed in the household, and also allowing for possession. So basically completely decriminalizing possession charges. So that's right out there. So definitely everybody look for your mailboxes. I think that they're going to be mailing them out And so if not, you can certainly go online and find it and sign the petition and hope that the Supreme Court won't kick this one off the ballot as well.
That would be great. So, but marijuana is not the only issue facing us here in Florida. I think it's a big one, and I'm glad to know you're on the right side. Though I got to say, you released your financial disclosure forms just a couple of weeks ago. The media made a big deal out of it. It was a month or two late, and it does show you have a big stake in one of the big medical marijuana firms. Is that a conflict of interest at all?
Not at all. First of all, it's a very, very small. Okay. These companies are really large. Yes. I have 604 shares of a publicly traded company. And so first of all, I do not regulate medical marijuana. So we can always start there that I have no regulatory oversight that's underneath Department of Health. So there is no conflict of interest. Nothing that I could do inside the Department of Agriculture would have any impact on the stocks of these companies. And two, what I've said very publicly, that if given the opportunity to be the next governor of the state of Florida, where I would regulate, I would be selling my shares way beforehand. So okay. There would be no conflict. Even though part of what we do as elected officials, we have to disclose this information, but there's nothing in ethics laws or anything of that nature that says we can't own, you know, stocks. I mean, look at Rick Scott. I mean, how much he ran, you know, look at his portfolio. He had stocks in everything that he oversaw. So even if that was the case, we would create such a buffer between myself and any involvement with the cannabis space that there would be no inherent conflict. But just to even deal with taking it out of anybody's conversations, I would sell my shares way before I became actually installed as governor.
Gotcha. Okay. That makes sense. Let's talk about some of the other things. Now, before you just got this position, you were elected in 2018. But that was the first time you had ever run for office. Yes.
Yes.
And so what were you doing before then?
I'm a practicing attorney. Mm-hmm. So I've been practicing law for about 15 years, everywhere from South Florida to Central Florida to North Florida, everything from a big silk stocking law firm, which was atrocious, did that for a year. Great people, but that was not why I went to law school. I went to law school to give back and to do good. Then went to the public defender's office where I was in Alachua County for 3.5 years, and then eventually made my way back to South Florida. And then prior to actually running, I was doing government consulting. I was representing Broward School Board, which I'm doing again today. So I never left that hat. Different type of representing them, but fighting with them along the way, fighting for our foster care children, represent an organization that is the voice of our foster care kids in Tallahassee and the medical marijuana space. So that was what I was doing before I ran in 2018 and took that courageous move to give my private life away and to give my life over to public service. And don't regret a single minute of it.
So you want to make the jump from attorney to agriculture commissioner to governor. What makes you qualified to be governor of the state of Florida?
Well, first of all, being again a Floridian my entire life, being a diehard, you know, I've been an activist for issues my entire life. I was fighting for gay pride back in high school and doing Habitat for Humanity and soup kitchens. And so I am passionate about what it is that we need to be doing here in the state. Now, as commissioner, I have been in the executive position and running an agency of 4,600, have $1.3 billion budget. So as far as my executive experience, I'm a small business owner, so I have also real life experience. And you know what? To be governor, you know what you need to know is qualifying aspect of being governor?
What?
You have to care. You have to care for the people that you govern.
Yeah.
That should be our number one qualifier for governor is, do you actually care about the people that you are planning on serving?
I guess that should bring us to talking about the guy currently holding the office, Ron DeSantis. Now, I have fun with his name all the time, but let's get serious here. Actually, when he was running 4 years ago, he was not the favorite. The favorite on the Republican side was Adam Putnam, who I believe, wasn't he the ag commissioner?
He was.
Yep. And he had been groomed to move up and be governor until, of course, Donald Trump comes in, starts talking about this backbencher congressman, Ron DeSantis, and endorsed him. And all of a sudden he shoots up and Adam Putnam is never to be heard from again. I'm not saying whether Adam Putnam would have been, I think anyone would have been better than Ron DeSantis. But this is historically one of the routes taken up through the channels to on the way to governor. Charlie Crist, who's the other Democrat running in the race, actually was governor. And on his way to becoming governor, he was attorney general of the state of Florida. Then when he was elected, he was a Republican. I remember those days back. I was working with Jim DeFede then. And then and then I guess he decided he wanted to go to the Senate, which was a mistake on his part. I guess, you know, Charlie Crist always is looking for the next job. And so and he wound up getting just pilloried, I think, due to the Tea Party movement. So he became an independent, and then eventually he became a Democrat, and now he's running for governor again, this time as a Democrat. Why are you better suited for this job than Charlie Crist?
You know, look, my tagline for my campaign is something new. And that's what we in the state of Florida need. This is what the Democratic Party wants. They want a fresh face, fresh perspective, somebody who's a winner. As somebody who is the only one who has won statewide as a Democrat in this race, and the people want to win. And the other thing that makes me qualified and why I will be the Democratic nominee is I've been a Democrat my entire life. What you are hearing today and people are seeing, I'm the same person that I was back in high school and middle school and elementary school. The same issues that I have been fighting for my entire life are the same issues that I stand up for today, whether it is abortion rights, whether it's criminal justice reform, whether it's medical marijuana and marijuana legalization, whether it's fighting food insecurity and affordable housing. These are issues that I have been in the trenches on, not just policy points that I decided to talk about because I'm running for office. This is why I decided to run, because these are things that have been part of who I am. And in the Jewish faith, which is what I am, we call it tikkun olam, to heal the world. And that is part ingrained in my soul. Everything I do, I wake up every day and say, how can I make the world a better place? And that's why, you know, when people are making a decision on the Democratic primary, they're going to want somebody who is honest. They're going to want somebody who is you know, dedicated to their convictions, somebody who is a fighter, a fierce fighter. I don't turn down challenges. I don't jump from position to position. I'm not a lifetime politician. I can honestly tell the people of the state of Florida, I have no desire to be president. I have no desire, you know, to do anything else besides govern our state. This is it. I'm not looking to, okay, if I don't win this time, I'll run next time. No, I am passionate about this job, this time frame, this position, because we are in a crisis in our country and in our state. And so people of our state need to decide, what side of history are you going to be on? Are you going to continue to fight for democracy and the things that we hold true in our state and create history, not only fight for history, create history with the first female governor of our state? And so when I have no doubt that when the Democrats have to make that choice in the ballot box, they will know that we need to try something new and that we need to have a true winner and fighter in our court. This is going to be a fight that we have never had before in this race. There's going to be more money flowing into the state of Florida than we have ever seen before, more attention on this race than we've ever seen before. And so we need somebody who is battle tested, who is able to take on Ron DeSantis. I make him squirm. He is prone to making mistakes, and I am prone to capitalizing on the mistakes that he makes. So that's why I'm the best suited to be that Democratic nominee and to fight head on with Ron DeSantis.
Nikki Fried is our guest. Again, she's running for governor here in the state of Florida. Find her website at NikkiFried.com, spelled fried, really, F-R-I-E-D. And on Twitter, same way, at Nikki Fried. All right. So Ron DeSantis is just, Florida's been a mess for a while, but he's made it a ridiculous mess. And there's nothing funny about it. COVID is raging here, even though people are denying it. Not only does he refuse any kind of mask mandates or vaccine mandates or to ask for a vaccine passport, but he ruled unilaterally, I guess, that no school board or any other entity in the state could initiate a mask mandate. Well, many school districts did. You mentioned you represent Broward County. I live in Broward County. I went to Broward County public schools from middle school on up. Where did you grow up?
Miami. So I went to Miami.
Okay. So yeah, I went to Hollywood Hills High School and Olson Middle School. We moved from New York. I went to Olson Middle School. So Broward County and Alachua County, you mentioned up in Gainesville area, were the first two to say, hold on, our kids are at risk here. We are going to institute a mask mandate. To make a long story short, DeSantis decided he's going to fine. First, he said he's going to fine the school board members $5,000 each if they institute this. Now he's saying he's going to fine individuals. What is he doing? Individuals who allow this to happen? $5,000 or each $5,000 for each employee who gets vaccinated or some nonsense. What is he doing now? You know better than I do.
Yes. So what happened is that he came up with this rule. And that he had an executive order that said that, yes, school districts could not have a mask requirement, mask mandate. And so we saw what happened. And, you know, I was a part of that big fight because I saw what was going on and told our school boards that I was going to get their back. And that's what we did. We called the White House and called the administration and said, this is what is happening in the state of Florida. We need help. And you saw almost days after my call to the White House that both President Biden and his press secretary came out in very strong support and said, look, if we are not going to let that happen. And so has in fact created a grant program for each school district and school board members to apply that if in fact he withholds money, which is now what he's threatening, to withhold their funds that equivalent to their salaries. So it's bad enough that he creates an executive order that he didn't have the power to create to begin with.
Right.
Ben has now gone out of his way to use taxpayer dollars to litigate this issue and continue to litigate this issue. Yep. But it's also now going to be withholding money. And so thank you, President Biden, for stepping up and helping us. What he now has taken is the next step is that we have, they passed a law this past session that says that no employer and no company can ask for, you know, they're calling it a you know, COVID passport.
Right.
I don't want to give in to what they're saying. So it's, you know, requiring the people to show that they have been vaccinated.
Right.
And so they are not allowed to do that, which again is crazy. We're in the middle of a healthcare crisis. And most importantly, whatever happened to free market? I was talking to a gentleman earlier today who owns barbecue restaurants all across the state of Florida. And I said to him, I said, look, if you so choose to want to make, you know, having vaccines for your patrons and know that you're going to lose 10 or 15% of your business to the Sunnies down the road, that's a business decision that is on you to make. It's not the government's decision. It should be you as a business owner. But now what he's done, and so that law did not touch employees. But now he's saying, wait a sec. And he actually has a press conference back in the day when this bill was passed that said it did not impact employees. And that was a personal decision and government shouldn't be involved in that. And now he's coming out and saying for every government agency, both as a school district, hospitals, law enforcement, first responders, and then local governments puts in any requirement that their employees get vaccinated, each incident,
$5,000.
$5,000 fine.
Unbelievable.
We're living crazy down here.
It's just unbelievable. It is stunning to me. And I walk around and I hear people regurgitating lies, stuff that's just simply not true. And they're getting it from this man. Nikki Fried, now I heard you're not in favor of mask mandates, are you?
So what I am in favor of is, you know, first of all, I called for mask mandate last year. I was very in front of the issue and said that that was really important. And I continue to say that we have to be masking. We have to follow the CDC guidelines. And the CDC guidelines, it's very clear. Mm-hmm. Anywhere you are indoors, you should be masking.
That's
up.
Right.
So I have said very clearly that we need to be following the CDC guidelines, which would be masking up everywhere inside, including in our schools. But I've also said that I believe in our local electeds, both on our city and county commissioners and our school boards, to be doing what is right for their communities and given the power to do that. Because look, at the end of the day, it was our county and city commissioners last year that all stepped up to the plate and got us through this pandemic. It was our business community and our local electeds, not the governor. The governor ran ahead. He hid behind everything and it was like, oh, I don't know what to do here, and allowed our locals to do it. And they did. And they stepped up and it was seamless. This time around, he wants all the power and doesn't want our local governments to do it. So I have been trying to empower our local governments They're the ones who are closest to the people, and that's where government should be, is closest to the people. They know their communities the best, and that's really where any kinds of requirements should be. But I've been very staunch on saying we need to be following the CDC guidelines, which is masking
good.
Up.
Okay, good to know. We've only got a few minutes left, and I have a million more questions for you, so maybe we can get together again. But I want to ask about redistricting, because that's coming up. And back 10 years ago, here in Florida, we passed a constitutional amendment, Fair Districts Florida, to have the congressional districts, all districts, drawn by an independent, nonpartisan committee. And that hasn't happened. It's all still very partisan. And here we go again. They're getting ready to redraw the districts, despite the fact that there are more registered Democrats in the state of Florida. Republicans control the legislature. What's going to happen here, and what should happen?
I'm very nervous. I've talked to our leadership in the House and the Senate. I've talked to our party leadership. I've talked to grassroots organizations, to labor organizations. This is going to be an all-on assault gerrymandering at its worst. And so what we have also seen is that there's also no transparency. They're not having hearings. Even 10 years ago, they went around the state and still had workshops and still had hearings. They have no intention of doing that this time around. And so I have said very clearly to all of my contemporaries in the Democratic Party and activists and grassroots organizations that we need to be getting that message out now. The message is very clear. This is going to be a partisan-driven process, and it's not going to be transparent. And they are going to gerrymander these districts against the Constitution. And unfortunately, we don't have the courts. The courts are not going to fare in a fair way, unfortunately. And the Supreme Court is more likely than not going to back up the maps that are coming out of the legislature. So this is something that we, the people, need to be talking about, getting in front of, be messaging with our elected officials on the Senate and the House, and tell them that that's not okay. And even if, this is what I keep saying too, even if the worst case outcome happens and they gerrymander these districts, we have got to vote like we have never voted before. And the NPAs that are out there are going to be the ones who have to help us hold them accountable and elect them out of office. But we're going to need everybody to understand.
NPA is no party affiliation.
Right.
Yes. Independence. Yes. Making sure everyone knows what you're talking about. Yeah.
Yes. And that we are going to need our non-party voters out there to stand up and say enough is enough. Enough of not following the Constitution. Enough of not following the statutes. Enough of creating a state that is only there to help the top 1%ers and the people that are staying in power. And they've got to stand up. And there's a reason why that they are NPAs, because they are tired of all of this.
Right.
And they don't want to pick a party. So it's time to send the party that has been in office for 25 straight years packing, because they are not following the rules anymore.
Well, let me tell you something from a registered Democrat, who is, because the alternative is so much worse. But the Democratic Party here in Florida is ineffective at best. And I'm being really generous here. I have a foul potty mouth, but I'm respecting who I have on with me, and I'm not going there. But I became a precinct committee person to help a progressive influx of voices into the Florida Democratic Party. The Florida Democratic Party has done everything they can to diss the progressive wing. They elected Manny Diaz as chair of the Democratic Party of Florida, who is the last person who should have a role in certainly Democratic Party politics, but any politics. I'm so disgusted with the party. It is dysfunctional on its best day and horrific on its worst. In fact, Manny Diaz took it upon himself to put out a press release excoriating the progressive caucus inside the Florida Democratic Party rather than dealing with moving forward. So that's I'm hoping if you get in there, you will somehow take control of the Democratic Party and whip it into shape, because that's another, I'm sorry, it's not working well for you, for any of us right now.
Yeah, and there is a huge problem. And I think that part of the problem is this. We haven't had, and I came in and I have been very honest too about this. I didn't wear, like, I've been a Democrat my entire life, but I haven't been involved in the Democratic Party. So my, when I first came into office, I didn't know a lot of the party leaders. I didn't know the chairs of each of the counties and the clubs. And so I spent a lot of time the last 2.5 years getting ingratiated with everybody, learning who everybody is, what is the background of some of the party stuff. And so it has been really important for me to get that ground, because you are right that there is such dysfunction within the party. And so I spent a lot of time on the phones, especially after November of 2020, listening and talking and giving them advice and suggestions about how to organize, how to fundraise, how to make sure that we are not going to the voters just before an election. That's not a winning combination. We got to be constantly, you know, going to the communities, going and talking to them and doing what I'm calling value added. You know, go, if it's Broward County, Broward should be doing beach cleanups every other weekend. They should be building Habitat for Humanities. If you're on the West Coast, you should be doing this and you should be doing that. How are we as Democrats showing the people of our state that we care more about them and the communities than we care about winning an election? And so the only way that we're going to win is to make people truly understand that we as a party care about their lives, care about making sure that there's food on their plates, that there's home, that there's roofs over their heads, that they've got, you know, a good paying jobs, and showing that support on the local level consistently. So what I have said, it's all about the message. It's having a consistent message, consistently messaging, and trusted messengers. And until the Democratic Party can figure out how to get that right, and I certainly hope that I am the conduit to make that happen in November of 2022. I've got not to be on air kind of conversation, but certainly I've got a game plan of how we're going to win in November, and how to make sure that we are building our bench and how we are organizing like we have never organized in the state. And it's going to take a leader that truly understands all of that to bring everybody together and start turning the page of this and bringing our party together. There shouldn't be internal fighting within the party. And unfortunately, that happens. And so we need a trusted leader to bring everybody together. And so, you know, given that I, you know, we'll be the nominee in August and then win in November, then we will be able to truly create a party that is sustainable and aren't turning over new leaders every 2 years, which is what has happened, and not have an internal structure in place.
All right. Nikki Fried, again, find her at NikkiFried.com, on Twitter at Nikki Fried. And by the way, you said say hi to Jim Defeatty for you.
Yes.
Jim's there. You can say hello.
Hello, Jim.
Jim Defeatty.
Hello. Long time no see. I was also a couple weekends ago, I was watching that fantastic
Come From Away. Right?
Cocaine Cowboys.
Cocaine Cowboys. You're all over Cocaine Cowboys, Jim Defeatty.
Yes. You're all over.
Oh, we're going to talk about that in a minute. Yes.
You're growing up in Miami, knew those stories oh too well.
Oh yes. All right.
Well, now that you're you know, wrapping up with Nicole and going national, maybe next time you have an invitation to come on my show and
anytime
talk about some of these issues.
I love it.
All right, Nikki, thank you so much. It was a pleasure meeting you. We'll talk again, I hope. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thanks.
All right, you take care. Bye bye. And thanks. Jim Defeatty. All right, my old pal, my old colleague. I told them at the beginning that I, you know, back in, what was it, like 2005? You were being brought on to WINZ, then the Progressive Talk Station in South Florida, to host the morning show. And here I was going, I was doing this video production thing because I had so soured on radio, but I contacted the station. I said, Jim is great, but you were a newspaper guy. I said, but he needs a radio person to work with him. And I wormed my way in and met with you. You had it down to me and one other person, and thankfully you chose me. And the other person was Joy Reid. So I've got that going
for
me.
She's been able to bounce back.
A little bit, slightly, yeah. She's done okay for herself. But so have you, Jim Defeatty, your investigative reporter at CBS4, the CBS-owned and operated station in Miami. And as I said earlier, you cover Florida politics better than anybody else. You host the Sunday morning Facing South Florida before Face the Nation on CBS. And you've been at CBS since like 2006, right?
2006, yeah, so 15 years.
Wow, time flies, huh?
It does something. It creaks, but yes, it also flies. Yeah.
It also flies. So you, Nikki mentioned Cocaine Cowboys, which is now a 3 or 4-parter on Netflix.
Six-parter.
Don't ask me. I'm not good with numbers. Yeah. But you're featured prominently throughout. It's like there's Tafiti again. So that's
Billy Corbin and Alfred Spellman, the filmmakers. They use me pretty much as the narrator for it because I spend so much time covering Falcone and Magluta, the two cocaine cowboys at the center of their documentary, all through the 1990s when I first got to South Florida. That's all I did for a decade was pretty much cover them and sit through their trials and write extensively about them when I was at Miami New Times.
Yeah, so you were at Miami New Times for a long time, and then you went over to the Miami Herald, and then you wound up doing radio and then CBS. And somewhere in there, shortly after 9/11, and this is what I jumped the gun on, you wrote a book. You wrote what turned out to be one of my favorite books. It's called The Day the World Came to Town. I'll tell you something. When I read this, and when I first met you, you never told me you wrote this book. I found out about the book after we weren't working together anymore. I read it after you were gone. But I fell in love with it. And it's the story. Why don't you tell us? Tell us about The Day the World Came to Town.
Sure. It was, I wrote it. It came out in 2002. And it's about the days immediately after 9/11, as I follow what occurred in a small town in Canada, Newfoundland, called Gander, Newfoundland. And as everyone knows, we're well aware since the anniversary just arrived, one of the things that the United States did was they shut down their airspace. And if you were flying from, for instance, from Los Angeles to Miami, and your plane was over Dallas at that particular moment, you landed in Dallas. You weren't allowed to continue on. Everyone was immediately grounded wherever they were going. Now, you had 400 international planes, and they were all told that they would not be allowed to enter U.S. airspace, in part because there was a very real fear that there could be more terrorists aboard those flights. And so the U.S. said any pilot who tries to enter U.S. airspace will be shot down. So the pilots didn't really fully comprehend what was happening. Some of them did, some didn't. And they continued onward, and it fell to Canada. And I interviewed recently Jean Chrétien, the prime minister on 9/11. And he said, I wish I could tell you that it was a momentous decision on our part. We just knew that it was the right thing to do to help the United States with those passengers and those planes, get them down safely. So we kept our airspace open so the planes could land. And 38 jetliners landed in the small town of Gander, Newfoundland. They landed in other places too, Halifax and Toronto and St. John's. But what makes Gander unique is it's a town of 10,000 people, and those 38 jetliners dropped off nearly 7,000 passengers.
Wow.
So the town nearly doubled in size overnight. And my book is about what occurred in the 5 days that many of those passengers were there.
If you don't mind, I'm going to take 2.5 minutes and play. You did a segment on CBS Weekend News last week on this that I want to show everybody. So this is a little bit more about the book and what Jim did back then.
When America was attacked on 9/11, 38 jetliners headed for the U.S. were diverted to the small town of Gander, Newfoundland. Locals called their sudden guests the plane people. Well, in years since, the hospitality has never been forgotten. Jim Defiti of our Miami station, WFOR, explains.
It's almost a hi.
Hi.
It's been 20 years since Roxanne Loper saw Bruce and Susan McLeod.
I have to go.
Bye, Susan.
Roxanne and her husband, Clark, were among the nearly 7,000 passengers stranded in Gander, Newfoundland on 9/11. Once on the ground, the passengers saw the horrors of that day. The folks in town were there to comfort them as they opened their doors for the better part of a week.
They would come to the Lions Club and say, hey, who needs a shower? Come over to my place.
We did what we had to do. People in need, and we were the ones to provide it.
A few weeks after 9/11, I went to Gander and wrote the book The Day the World Came to Town, about the kindness shown to the plain people as the folks in town referred to their unexpected guests.
Let's make these people honorary Newfoundlanders!
The Broadway musical Come From Away recounted this remarkable tale.
You've seen people coming up to passengers, locals, and giving them that hug. Don't you worry about a thing. We got you.
Oz Fudge was the town constable in Gander on 9/11 and one of the first people I met.
If you look at the world today and you look at what's happening and you see on the TV and you see on your Facebook and everything how people are getting angry at each other. And they're fighting on airplanes, and they're fighting on trains, and they're fighting in grocery stores. And now people are looking at this play and reading the books and seeing the documentaries and going, I remember. That's what it was like when I was growing up. And they're longing for that.
For Roxanne, 9/11 was an especially scary time. She was bringing home Alexandra, a 2-year-old infant she adopted in Kazakhstan. Now 22, Alexandra is well aware of what happened on that fateful day.
I've tried to instill in all of my kids to continue with that kindness. You know, anytime they see anyone that needs any help, we don't know their story. We don't know what they're going through. We just know they need help. So help them.
Reporting for CBS News, I'm Jim DeFede, Miami.
Jim, that story is amazing. And when I watched it, we need to meet Alexandra. You know, Allison, I adopted from Kazakhstan, and she's now 22. I didn't make that connection.
Yeah, no. And I talked to Alexandra because the book, I did an update 20 years later on many of the characters and wrote a new afterword to the book and a new preface to the book. And I had a chance to talk to Alexandra, who's now 22 years old.
Yeah.
And obviously doesn't really remember her time in Gander, but is well aware of that sort of hospitality that her family was shown. And as Roxanne said, she's instilled in all of her kids that desire to, you know, to help, to reach out and help people who may need it. It's a feeling that's in short supply these days. I certainly am not sure that I know that the folks in Gander would do the same thing again. I'm not sure we would see it repeated too many other places.
Right. And I just looked over in the chat room and somebody said, John Doe actually said, what the hell happened to us? I don't know that we were ever that hospitable. The people in Gander, as I learned from your book, were amazingly welcoming and just wonderful people because that's how they are. We could all learn something from them. And that's why the book is so heartwarming because, as I said, when I tweeted about it before last weekend, saying if you need something uplifting this weekend, read this book and watch Come From Away, which is now streaming on, I think, Apple TV.
Apple.
And I watched it for the first time and loved it. But, you know, it's a wonderful story that will reaffirm your faith in humanity, which we could all use right about now.
Yeah, you know, it's what intrigued me about writing the story was that notion that out of all the darkness that you saw on 9/11, all the, you know, just the tragic nature of everything, that something good could emerge, that there were some people who had good memories. And I think specifically about Hannah and Dennis O'Rourke, who were on the plane, were stranded in Gander. They were coming home to New York from a trip to Ireland. And the first thing they thought of when they heard about what occurred was their son, Kevin, a New York City firefighter, who was part of an elite rescue unit, Rescue 2. And, you know, the town people rallied around Hannah and Dennis. And there was one woman in particular, Beulah Cooper, who spent every day sitting with Hannah, often walking her to the Catholic church in town and just telling her off color jokes and just trying to keep her mind active on other things. And it wasn't until they got home, the O'Rourkes, that they found out that their son did, in fact, die and his body was recovered. But when I wrote the book, I delivered an advanced copy to the O'Rourkes and I sat with them in their living room. And I can remember sitting there, it was near the first anniversary of 9/11. And, you know, Hannah was particularly a bit downcast and as you can expect, you know, coming up on the first anniversary, and her other daughter and her other son was there. And when they would see their mom getting sort of sad, they would bring up Beulah. What was that joke that Beulah told you? Aww. And what about Tom? And Hannah would brighten up and smile and recount something. And that's when I realized that in a time where she should have no good memory, there shouldn't be anything that she could cling to during that time. The folks in Gander gave her something to hold on to, as you say, to reaffirm the basic goodness of people. And so that's something that stayed. And I will tell you that Hannah O'Rourke and Beulah Cooper Beulah remain friends to this day. And in fact, you know, not to get too maudlin, but, you know, Beulah's husband died over the past 20 years, and Hannah helped her get through that. And then Hannah's husband, Dennis, died, and Beulah helped her get through that. Wow. And so, you know, it's just sort of like this bond that has formed between these two. And there were lots of bonds like that were formed, friendships that were made.
Sure.
That continue 20 years later.
It's amazing. And not, you know, not take anything away from the book, because you got to read the book because it's more in depth. But the play Come From Away, which went on Broadway and won all kinds of awards, tells their story as well. They're very prominently featured. And I encourage people to watch it. If you have Apple television, by all means, watch it. But also read the book, because it'll blow your mind. Jim DeFede. So this is very different than the work you do on a daily basis here in South Florida. You have said about Florida politics, I don't want to put words into it. Tell us, what would you say if someone asked you, what are politics like in Florida, Jim DeFede?
Messy, I think, would be the word I would use. I think that's the most polite term you use. And you're right. The book that I wrote was nothing like what I normally cover.
No.
You know, generally I'm cynical and dark by nature. Yes. And untrusting of people. And this book is filled with just the opposite. So I have to sort of warn people that it's not a typical Jim DeFede sort of approach. Florida politics are messy and often a mess. It's one of the reasons why I do enjoy being a reporter here. I used to sort of tell people, and sometimes they wouldn't understand the joke and they would get upset. They would ask me, how do I decide who to vote for? And I say, I always vote, for instance, for bond issues. I always vote yes on bond issues. And they said, no matter what, I said, oh, absolutely. Always vote yes on bond issues. Why? I said, because the more money government has, the greater chance they have of somebody stealing it, and the better off I am in being able to uncover that theft. So it's job security. I always vote for bond issues, and I vote for the worst candidate in the election every time, because always vote for the crook, because they will give you something to write about. To
oh, my God. So you so would I, vote I'm, for Ron death sentence again?
I vote based on my own self-interest of job security and wanting to have interesting things to cover. And if not, I would probably move back to Spokane, Washington, where I used to live before moving to Miami. I worked at the paper there.
Uh-huh.
In Spokane, Washington, and there's not a lot of crime and corruption.
No.
Nazis every once in a while, but mostly, but otherwise considered a nice place to raise a family.
I hear you. Miami, not so much. We are, I call it Florida for good reason. But, you know, when you and I worked together, the governor was Charlie Crist, a Republican.
Republican guy.
And yes, you used to refer to him as Charlie Crist, the Republican, the best Democratic governor that Florida has had in a long time. It was a joke because he was not your typical Republican, but he wasn't a Democrat either. Did you ever envision him running for governor again?
It doesn't surprise me. Charlie likes public service. I think that's a charitable way to phrase it. He likes running.
Yeah.
He's run statewide many times. He was the attorney general. Yeah. Back when he was attorney general, he was known as Chain Gang Charlie because he wanted to portray himself as being tough on crime.
Yeah.
And I think he was also Secretary of Education at one time and attorney general, yeah, as I said, and then governor.
And then he ran for the Senate, and he didn't win. And then he changed parties, and then he ran for the House, and he's in the House now, has been, I think, for two terms, and now he's running for governor again. By the way,
Charlie was an early canary in the coal mine for the Republican Party, because what did Charlie Crist in was, during a meeting in Southwest Florida, when the president had gotten some funding for Florida and was in the state touting it. This was President Obama at the time. And Charlie Crist and him were on stage together.
Right.
And they gave a brief hug. You know, wasn't, you know, a nice little embrace.
That's right. And I forgot about that.
That image, that picture was used as basically saying he's not a real Republican. And so therefore you have to vote him out. So, and when he lost the Senate race, he lost that first Senate race to Marco Rubio, who rose to prominence on the backing of the Tea Party, the original Tea Party.
Yep.
And that's, so like I said, Charlie has that interesting place in history where I think he was, as I said, sort of the canary in the Republican coal mine.
Right. Well, I should mention, we had Nikki Fried on in the first half hour. Charlie Crist is going to join us a week from tomorrow. So we're doing the equal time thing here. I need to figure out who I want to vote for. And frankly, I honestly don't know. I just know that I don't want Ron DeSantis again. I thought Rick Scott was horrible. And Ron DeSantis is a whole new level of duh in Florida to me. I'm not going to ask you to comment on that. You're a journalist.
No, I'm not going to.
I know.
And I do want to say one thing. I get it. You know, you're passionate about what you believe in. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure Democrats help themselves when they do the death Santas.
Really? You know, a death sentence, but okay.
You know, but whatever it is, it's like, you know, argue the facts.
Right.
You know, argue the facts. It's when we get into the name calling.
I got
both
you,
sides,
and I understand that.
That's problematic.
I do understand
anyway,
that.
Go ahead.
I just look
I'm
at
off
it.
My soapbox
you know,
now. Go
thank
ahead.
God you know my daughter. You knew her when she was young and a pain in the ass and running around the studio and stealing, you know, pancakes from Steve Harvey, who got all the good private chef at Clear Channel, and we didn't. But she, you know, if she were still in school, I'd be having heart attacks right now. I'm so glad she's out of school and I don't have to deal with the mask stuff. What he's doing to our school children, I think, is horrible. And I don't understand why he's trying to kill off the people of Florida.
Well, you know, look, again, I'm not here to speak on his behalf.
No.
I'm not here to vilify him either. It's, you know, I mean, I think what's fascinating to me about the arc of COVID in Florida is you can make the case, and I think there's truth to it, that he got the early part of the pandemic 100% right, whereas other states did not. While New York and California were not shutting down and isolating their nursing homes and assisted living facilities, Florida did.
Mm-hmm.
Florida's emphasis was on their elderly population.
The elderly, you're right. And they were the first to get the vaccines. True.
Yeah, and there's two ways to look at that. One is, they were the most vulnerable population, so it made sense to go and protect the most vulnerable population. The other is older Americans are also reliably Republican, and particularly places like the Villages and other things are central to any Republican winning in the state of Florida. But giving him the benefit of the doubt, he was right in those early days. And I think that what the takeaway for him was, you know, unlike a lot of people, I will tell you, in talking to his staff, the people around him, and I've covered him for a long time now, he's a voracious reader.
Is
he? And it's sometimes I think the issue is a little bit of knowledge can be a dangerous thing.
Oh,
and so
yeah.
He reads the studies, he absorbs the studies, and then he processes them so he can have an argument with people. I think he gets backed into a corner. I think when he does himself the best, the worst aspects of himself come out when he constantly feels cornered. He does not, I mean, it's charitable to say he does not like the media. He hates them.
he's rude and condescending.
Someone,
yeah.
So he is unlikely to be someone who will acknowledge, you know, a change of course or direction. So I think where he gets into trouble sometimes is where he locks in on a position and won't deviate from it, even though circumstances on the ground may change. Now, that's been a problem that the CDC and the NIH have had, and the federal government, is that they shift and change what their recommendations are with regard to vaccines and mask wearing, and when you can wear a mask, when you shouldn't wear a mask.
But at least they'll change.
The argument is that it changes because the circumstances change. It's not static. You know, so that becomes where it gets tricky. I think in his mind he believes he's doing what he thinks is right? I know the people around him believe that he believes everything he says is accurate and right. The problem is that he remains too much in a cocoon of Fox News, and not even more general Fox News, but of just certain hosts on Fox News. Their morning show, you know, and their evening host.
Sure, the most partisan, the ones who are going to do the dirty work for him.
He doesn't go on Chris Wallace's show.
No.
He doesn't do that. I mean, I interviewed him a year ago, and all of his people were very happy, thought the interview was fair. I pushed him and asked tough questions, and he's not someone who shies away from a tough question, which is why I don't understand his refusal to do any local press. Now he has these press conferences where he gets angry quickly at the reporters and then storms away.
Right.
And I hope he'll sit down, because I think the voters in Florida deserve to see him answer the questions that need to be asked.
Right.
I don't envision him doing any debates. I don't know that won't be the case, but I can't see him debating any of his Democratic challengers, no matter who they are.
I can't see it either. If he's going to sit down with someone, though, it would be you. So hopefully you get another shot at him. Jim DeFede, we're getting close to the end of the half hour, and I may keep you over a couple extra minutes, because this is something I've been wanting to ask you about for a while, and I was going to have you back on, and then Surfside happened, and it was just one thing after another. There's no shortage of big news and tragedy here in South Florida. But I wanted to ask you, and you did a big segment on this, you've covered the story. During the last election, the presidential elections, South Florida, Miami, most notably, went hard for the Republican, went for Trump, much more so than was expected, and that usually happens. Miami-Dade is usually a little bluer than that. And a lot of fingers were pointed at Spanish language radio, where, you know, lies are being told. And I don't know, did the Democrats not have people speaking Spanish monitoring the stuff to know what's going on there? I understand there was a big disinformation campaign that still goes on to this day. Can you tell us what the story is with Spanish language right-wing talk radio in Miami?
Yeah, it's a major influence. It's funny because it's what's old is new again. This was something that was very prominent in Miami in the 80s during when Reagan was in. You had local radio, which was locally owned radio stations doing, you know, very, very hard-edged right-wing talk. Mm-hmm. And they were very influential, a lot of those radio hosts. Then some of the bigger stations, as all stations did, get gobbled up in the corporate takeover of radio stations. And you saw that decline. But it really did reemerge. In part, it's this weird cycle where stuff gets said on social media, usually on through Facebook or more prominently on WhatsApp. A lot of Americans don't use WhatsApp.
Right. But
WhatsApp is a very, very huge tool in Latin America and throughout the rest of the world. And so you have these you know, cells that would create of families and friends. And you saw it with COVID. You saw it with politics. You know, the notion that Joe Biden was a pedophile was a major theme, and you would hear this over and over again, and a lot of these stories would come out of Latin America. They would get repeated, and one of the things that they found in the research is that if my cousin tells me something, you know, from Colombia, I'm more likely to believe it than if I read a newspaper. And so social media became the primary conduit for information. Mm-hmm. And then that social media would then get picked up by these radio stations, by these radio show hosts who would begin repeating them as well. And that created the cycle of you know, the Democrats are all socialists. And by the way, socialism became even a harsher word than communism in the Latin American community, because they have that touchstone of seeing countries who have gone socialist. And the type of socialism that Bernie Sanders talks about is, of course, nothing compared to the type of socialism that you would see in Venezuela. Right. Or, you know, what you're not even really talking in terms of Venezuela and Cuba. That's not socialism. That's authoritarianism. Right. That's dictatorship. Right. That's something completely different. But it gets caught under the rubric of socialism. So then it gets repeated on Spanish radio. It's on the Facebook pages. And by the time the Democrats started seeing it in 2020, it was too late. The opinions had been hardened to the point where you said, you know, Dade usually goes a little bit better blue. I mean, you know, you're talking about, you know, Hillary Clinton winning Dade County by 27 points.
Wow.
You know, this time around, Joe Biden won it by less than 9.
Wow.
I think 7 or 8, actually. And so that's a huge swing. So the Republicans aren't going to win Dade County. But when you eat up that much into the Democratic votes, you can't make it up in other parts of the state. Even in Broward, you saw some of that come to pass.
Yeah.
But particularly in Dade, and this was the Spanish language media, and that attack of socialism,
yes,
that they're all socialists. Democrats never really had an answer. I think initially the Democrats' response was, well, who's going to believe Donna Shalala is a socialist?
Right.
Who's going to believe that Joe Biden beat the socialist? You know, Joe Biden beat Bernie Sanders. So the proof is right there. Joe Biden isn't a socialist. You can't be.
And Bernie Sanders is not that kind of a socialist. They're talking apples and oranges.
But even still, the notion of you know, Biden just saying, oh, nobody's going to believe that.
Right.
Donna Shalala, nobody's going to believe that. Debbie Mercosell Powell, nobody's going to believe that. Well, they all got bit. And so that's why I saw somewhere, but I haven't locked down on the particulars, but my understanding is the DNC is trying to create now something that will monitor more closely Spanish language radio and do sort of a rapid response to it. Also putting pressure now on those corporate entities like Univision that own some of these radio stations to put pressure on them, you know, so that their hosts are not spewing outright lies and falsehoods. And it's not just the politics. It's also, you know, having to deal with the pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
And you see a lot of misinformation with regard to the vaccines, with regard to mask wearing. It's also a major place where you hear a lot of QAnon conspiracies.
Yes.
The QAnon conspiracies really take hold on Spanish radio. And it's a disturbing trend and one that, you know, most non-Spanish speaking folks in South Florida would ignore it. That's why I wanted to dedicate a half an hour and actually several shows to that issue, because it's something that's sort of taking place, but is almost seen as something on the side when it needs to be brought to the forefront so that people better understand.
Without a doubt, which is why I wanted to ask you about it. And I did watch, you know, Facing South Florida is on like 8 o'clock in the morning on Sundays here in South Florida, but
very early.
Very early.
You gotta get up, you milk the cows, and then you come in and you watch Facing South Florida at 8:30.
Right. Or you go to CBS4.com and you can find it.
CBSMiami.com, I think that's what it is.
CBSMiami.com. CBS4.com gets you there too, case you're wondering. It does.
More ways you want.
CBSMiami.com is the easiest way. We'll get you there and you can watch Facing South Florida. And I watched a couple of those, and the one, and I don't know the names, I feel stupid, but the woman who's like huge, and you interviewed her and she seemed oblivious to everything you were saying to her or asking her, just didn't want to know from it, didn't want to hear that she's giving bad information. So that seems like there's a real...
I think you're talking about Ninoska Perez.
Yes,
she's been around
exactly.
for decades. She was part of that old guard that I talked about.
Mm-hmm.
And then has always been around. And I'll give Ninoska credit. She came on. She defended what she believes. And you know, and I think that's a healthy thing to do. And, you know, like Ninoska's a survivor. She's been in this town, in this community for a long time. But yeah, we're seeing it more and more. And if the Democrats don't have a better answer for the socialism argument, whether it's Nikki Fried or Charlie Crist, and, you know, I don't know if you've reported on this, but, you know, it's almost certain that Annette Tadeo, the state senator, is going to be getting into the race.
Into the governor's race?
Governor's race. She's jumping into the governor's race in the next couple of weeks.
Really? And that's surprising to me.
She thinks she's in the best position to counter the socialism argument.
Because she's Hispanic. We know Annette Tadeo, but here's the thing. She's been around for a long time. She's never won a statewide election before, and she's tried a number of times.
I don't know. She was Charlie Crist's lieutenant governor candidate when he ran. I don't think she's ever run statewide other than that. So she was part of Charlie Crist's campaign 4 years ago, or whenever it was, 6 years ago. That he lost to Rick Scott.
Right.
The race before DeSantis's. The race for Rick Scott's second term.
Yes.
So 6 years ago.
Okay.
She was his lieutenant governor candidate. So the fact that she's jumping into the race while Charlie Crist is there is an interesting side note as well. But yeah, no, she's her father was kidnapped by the FARC. So she understands the dangers of that sort of authoritarianism, that sort of guerrilla movement, that sort of argument, and feels that you can't touch her with that. Hmm. Now, I think to your point, how well known is she outside of Miami-Dade? I would say that she's the least well known of the candidates running for governor.
Mm-hmm.
And would have a difficult time if I was handicapping the race, but who knows? It's a long way to the, it's almost a year to the primary.
Well, it is. And that opens the door. I mean, do you think anybody else is going to jump in? Because I was surprised there's only two. So now three. What about Dan Gelber?
Dan's not jumping.
No?
No.
He wouldn't do it?
No, I don't see Dan Gelber, the mayor of Miami Beach, running. Again, he is a creature of South Florida that I'm not sure how well he would play
statewide
elsewhere. Right. He ran for attorney general.
Yes, I remember.
I can't remember how long ago, and did not fare well.
Right.
There are lots of reasons for it. I mean, I'm not sure how open other parts of the state are to anyone from Miami-Dade. That tends to be a problem. They tend to look down on folks from Miami-Dade and the rest of the state. So, but yeah, we'll see.
We'll see. Jim DeFede, I've kept you for longer than I said I would. I appreciate it so much. I miss you. It's great to see you. It's great to talk to you.
Good to see you. Congratulations on all your success.
I don't know if they call it success, but I'm hanging in there, you know, so I got that
going for me. You got good artwork behind you. That's half the battle.
Hey, I'm painting. That's my pandemic silver lining. I've been painting. I paint.
Wow.
I do pet portraits now. You don't have a pet, but this is my latest. This is like the faux stained glass stuff, but I'm doing pet portraits.
So you and George W. Bush.
Go figure, right?
Just simpatico.
Look at that. Who would have thought? Who would have ever thought?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
All right.
Well, I'll have to look into getting an original sandler.
Oh, without a doubt. I'll send you a link to where my stuff is posted. It's on my website. I have pandemic painting, but I haven't put anything new there. But seriously, I hadn't painted like maybe since I was 12. And last October, I was bored. I ordered a set of paints from Amazon. And now I have like a side business painting pet portraits. Go figure. Stranger things have happened, right?
That's there you good. Go.
And
everyone needs a side hustle.
That's right. And I'm 5 years cancer free. That's the thing to congratulate me for. Do you believe that's been 5 years?
You on that.
Oh
yes.
My God, Jim DeFede. I miss the old days a little bit. I miss working with you. I don't miss the hallways of Clear Channel. But it's great seeing you, and thank you so much for being with us today.
No problem, Nicole. Have a good day.
You too. Bye-bye. Jim DeFede, everyone. One of my favorite people, and he really is good. And you go to CBS4.com and you can see his work, and you should. And read the book, The Day the World Came to Town. I promise you, you'll love it. I read it, and I started reading it, and I couldn't put it down. I swear I read the whole thing. Like, I broke for 4 hours to sleep, and that's it. All right. Tomorrow, Tuesday, Gotta Laugh will be here. Wednesday, Dave Zirin will be here. So we got a busy week for you. And then Charlie Crist a week from tomorrow. All right. I will leave you with the news because we can. And I'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for listening, everyone. Hope that was as good for you as it was for me. And yeah, I'll see you tomorrow. Bye. Whoops. Would help if I put the wrong pot, right pot up.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
The House returns from their excessively long summer recess Monday, joining the Senate, who returned last week. And their plates are not just full, they're overloaded. And it appears that some of the ingredients have gone bad while they were on a break. Congress is trying to negotiate a two-step infrastructure package, avert a government shutdown, and figure out how to raise the debt ceiling while Mitch McConnell continues playing his obstructionist Grim Reaper game, refusing to help. And now Joe Manchin is predictably rearing his ugly head, this time suggesting that they wait until 2022 to continue work on the dual infrastructure legislation. Oh, and not to be upstaged, Kyrsten Sinema reportedly told the president in a private meeting last week that if the House delays its scheduled vote from September 27th on the so-called bipartisan infrastructure plan, or if the vote fails, she will not vote for the reconciliation package. Both Sinema and Manchin are reportedly huddling with many of the House conservadems, don't call them moderates, threatening to tank the entire package, like Kurt Schrader of Oregon. And a group of about 10 other members of the Republican wing of the Democratic Party, they're sending a message to the White House that if they delay the vote or it goes down on September 27th, they will kill the BIF, or the bipartisan part of the bill that's already passed the Senate. This threat comes just a couple of days after Congressional Progressive Caucus Chair Pramila Jayapal declared that the House progressives had the votes to tank that BIF, the infrastructure plan, unless it's paired with the larger $3.5 trillion over 10-year reconciliation package. But it's become very clear that this reconciliation bill won't be ready a week from today, the date that Nancy Pelosi promised the conservadems a vote on the $1.2 trillion hard infrastructure bill. Confused yet? Wait, there's more. The Senate parliamentarian on Sunday night, quote, determined that the Democrats' proposal is by any standard a broad new immigration policy and that the policy change substantially outweighs the budgetary impact of that change. So the Democrats can't include immigration provisions in that package. Lovely. On the COVID front, on Friday, an FDA advisory panel recommended that adults 65 and older and immunocompromised people get a Pfizer booster vaccine 6 months after their second dose. This despite Biden's plans to roll them out for everyone 12 and up beginning on Monday. Both Moderna and Johnson & Johnson are still in the testing phase regarding boosters. More encouraging news, Pfizer released new data Monday morning saying that a low dose of their vaccine is safe and effective in children ages 5 to 11. This data is a crucial step toward the two-shot coronavirus regimen being available for children, perhaps by Halloween. The companies must still prepare and submit the data to the Food and Drug Administration, a process they expect to be complete by the end of this month. And it won't be a minute too soon. Skyrocketing COVID-19 cases are forcing hospitals to ration care, leading to life or death decisions, even for those without the virus. About 80% of ICU beds in the country are in use, nearly 30% of them occupied by COVID-19 patients. In the past week alone, the U.S. has averaged around 1,926 COVID-19 deaths each day. That's the highest average since early March. As the 76th U.N. General Assembly kicks off this week, high-level talks are going on with world leaders meeting to debate two major global challenges: ending the pandemic and forging a healthier economy. Other issues are on the table, too, likely including the military coup in Myanmar, the future of democracy in a Taliban-ruled Afghanistan, tensions with Iran and North Korea and China, and climate issues. Yeah. Despite urging from the U.S. government to attend the meeting virtually, though, more than 100 heads of state and governments are due in Manhattan in person including UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson, Indian Prime Minister Modi, and of course, US President Joe Biden. If it's Monday, Canadians head to the polls in a snap election that could either improve Justin Trudeau's position or further polarize the country's government. Trudeau called the snap election in mid-August, just about 2 years into his minority government, thinking that he could capitalize on his handling of the pandemic to win a majority in Parliament. But Canada's Conservative Party, led by Erin O'Toole, has mounted a significant challenge. Major issues like the pandemic, climate change, affordable housing, and gun control are issues facing Canadians, but many citizens don't feel the need for the election and are annoyed with the political posturing and vitriol that has accompanied it. Check this out. A chartered Qatar Airways flight carrying more than 230 passengers, including both Afghan and American citizens, took off from Kabul's airport on Sunday. This airlift was the largest such evacuation flight since the U.S. military withdrawal from the country was completed on August 31st. The flight came as concerns continued about the Taliban's willingness to allow the departures of Afghans and foreigners desperate to leave Afghanistan rather than stay there under Taliban control. A Qatari official told Reuters that the country, quote, will continue its collaboration with international partners on efforts that ensure freedom of movement in Afghanistan. The Emmys went off on Sunday night. The big winners were The Crown and Ted Lasso, with broadcast television barely registering a blip, just saying. And finally, as fall approaches and colder temperatures near, the harvest moon will show up Monday night. It's called the harvest moon because it traditionally gave farmers more time to harvest their summer crops as fall approaches. This year, it'll appear 2 days before the autumn equinox. The full moon can first be seen at 7:55 p.m. Eastern Time, 17 minutes after sunset, Monday night. Enjoy. And that's just a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is fully listener-supported, and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com, and please click on that donate button.